We're having an active debate about who believes we should be on time and who doesn't. It's 1-to-1 so far. But let's get going. This is a very important session, and I want to thank you for coming. We're going to talk in a little bit of a different tone and subject matter than a lot of the rest of the meeting. We're not going to be talking about great progress. We're going to be talking about the places where we need to make progress, and we haven't. I think that you will agree after you hear our speakers that this is a critically important public health issue, that people are getting hurt by the adverse consequences of drugs, and that this information is not accessible in ways that physicians and the public reasonably believe that it is and it should be. So we are going to be talking about adverse drug reactions. We're indebted to Don Light here, for putting this session together, and I thank you, Don, for including me in this. Don is the author of a recently published book, The Risks of Prescription Drugs, and he'll lead off our session discussing the scope of adverse drug reactions and challenges. After Don finishes, Julie Zito will talk about an extremely important subject, which is the trends in the use of antipsychotic drugs among community-based youth. And if there's one area that epitomizes the excess of marketing and off-label profiteering by the pharmaceutical industry, it's going to be what Julie is going to talk about. Howard Brody is going to talk to us about the impact of prescription drug patents, and he's going to discuss an idea that he and Don came up with, which I think is absolutely brilliant, called the inverse benefit law. Then we expect that Senator Bernie Sanders is going to come and talk to us about a proposal that he has for disconnecting pharmaceutical research and development from pharmaceutical marketing. And a radical idea, one might say politically challenging, but it, to even consider the idea, highlights the problem and creates a conceptual framework that I think is very important to think about. And then after Senator Sanders speaks, I'll speak about the market failure in medical knowledge, not just system delivery, but in medical knowledge itself. So with that as an introduction, Don Light is going to be our first speaker. He's a medical and economic sociologist. He does policy research on issues of distributive justice concerning health insurance and access to medical services and drugs. His recent work concerns the epidemiology of harmful side effects of prescription drugs, and he has recently published a book called The Risks of Prescription Drugs. He'll be talking about institutional barriers to more effective, safer drugs and global vaccine policy. Don Light is currently the Loki Visiting Professor at Stanford University, where he's teaching a course on health policy from an international perspective, and he is a professor at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey. Don, please.
Thank you very much. First, a reminder that Senator Sanders has been honored with an evening with tomorrow at 6:30. It should be a delightful evening event at Constitutional Ballroom here in the Grand Hyatt. It's all on your chairs, so you can take it with you. Does this work? Yeah. The studies that we have, especially careful studies of the records of hospitalized patients, indicate that there are about, in 2010, 2.7 million serious adverse drug reactions amongst hospitalized patients who have received proper prescriptions, and about 129,000 deaths. That makes it the fourth leading cause of death. There's been some careful British studies, particularly by Tom Wally, who now oversees clinical trials for the National Health Service. And I have in here many issues of recording, measuring, and methods, because one thing that strikes one is the paucity of funded and serious research in this area for a leading cause of injury, illness, hospitalization, and death. These estimates do not include ADRs due to overdose, errors in administration, and other effects of overselling and confusing brands. It does not account many serious reactions outside the hospital, in home, work, or nursing homes, or many deaths due to falls and accidents, prescription drugs. In a lead article in the New York Times and a report by the DEA, is now considered a greater source of accidents, trucker and automobile accidents, than alcohol. So there are a lot of things not included in this estimate, and if they were included in some responsible way, so there's a whole area for further epidemiological research, maybe, I'm not sure, it might even be the third leading cause of death. There are about 20 to 46 million ADRs a year. Most of them are quite mild from a medical point of view, but from a functional point of view, they can make people sleepy or lightheaded, have muscle sores and aches, slow their reaction times, make them irritable, and in other ways impair their judgment and functioning. And about 1.5 million hospitalizations a year from serious drug reactions, an estimated 3.75 million worldwide. Now, are these harms the price of progress? Millions benefit from the 1 in 7 new drugs superior to existing drugs against hard clinical endpoints. And over time, they add up to an impressive medicine chest from which we all benefit. But what's struck me as an economic and medical sociologist is that 6 out of every 7 new drugs, although perhaps superior to placebo or non-inferior to a comparator, and often against a surrogate endpoint, do not prove to be to have much or any advantage over existing drugs. So there's little offset benefit for the risk of harms. And that is at the heart of this book. You see a little yellow flyer around the room on the risks of prescription drugs, which is now at the APHA bookstore, as well as readily available on Amazon, and was written for lay people's commissioned by the MacArthur Foundation. None of us get any royalties, right? Okay. Just check with the boss here. Okay, so here's a 10-year overview. 983 new drugs approved in a 10-year period. Two of them were major breakthroughs. 38 were considered important therapeutic advances. This is done by an independent group of pharmacists and physicians in France. This is the Prescrire International work. But it's not unlike the Canadian board's figures, the Australian board's figures, the German board's figures, and the Scottish board's figures. 106 have some therapeutic advantages, but do not change practice, and the rest have minimal or no clinical advantage, and some may be more harmful than upon reviewing. Now, this pattern is not new, so evaluations since the 1960s have consistently found the same proportions, about 10, 12, 14, 15% therapeutically superior new drugs, and 85, 87, 80, 9 or 91% in a new Dutch study as therapeutically little or no better. And many are under-tested for harmful side effects. Only 1.3% of pharmaceutical sales, net of taxpayer subsidies, are used for basic research to discover new molecules. That's in a BMJ piece by Joel Lection and me in 2005. Based on company data and government studies. So most R&D appears to be devoted to developing scores of minor variation drugs to fill the sales line for the market force. Behind this is something that in the book we developed to try to understand why this is happening as the risk proliferation syndrome, a set of institutional practices that actually reward companies to developed so many minor variations and under-tests for harms. First, the regulatory criteria are quite weak. This is now changing in Europe, but drugs have been approved for decades, and largely now as better than placebo or non-inferior to comparators. And surrogate endpoints are often allowed, that is, substitute endpoints to actual clinical endpoints. Having companies design and run their own trials is a blatant conflict of interest, and they understandably design those trials to maximize evidence of benefit and minimize evidence of harm. We do that as well, and our jobs would depend on it if that was our job. The speeding up of approvals after the pharmaceutical industry started funding the FDA for reviewing its own drugs, another conflict of interest, has been shown through rather rigorous work by Mary Olson, who's now at Tulane, was at Yale when she did the work, and David Carpenter, to increase the likelihood of hospitalizations or death or black box warnings or withdrawals through speed up reviews. And then creating a bias, medical literature and medical, quote, science, we now have extensive detailed studies from court cases and from various kinds of archives about ghost management and ghost writing. My favorite detail about this is that the ghost writers are so good that their submissions are more likely to be accepted by Lancet and the New England Journal than ones that are actually written by scientists. Colonizing medical science and practice and mass marketing the inverse benefit law, promoting unapproved uses, which is illegal, but they have created an extensive network of thought leaders, opinion leaders, key opinion leaders, and other people to do a variety of, quote, trials that are usually not scientifically designed to produce valid information, and then published in sponsored supplements and minor journals, and then handed out to colleagues and talked about at seminars and grand rounds, places like that. Turning doctors into double agents, more than 90% of all American physicians say they've received gifts and benefits from pharmaceutical companies, but they don't tell their patients. Direct-to-consumer advertising that mobilizes patients to be demanding various products that often they don't need, and proliferating new risks and diseases. When I think about this, you know, what is driving these practices? It seems to me it's high prices, which is what Senator Sanders' new bill particularly focuses on. His first aim is to get the prices of drugs very much lower and much more affordable and accessible by giving large prizes to any company, and this, by the way, opens things up to small biotechs where most of the innovation occurs, and then having the patents in the public domain so there can be generic price competition and very low prices. Most pills cost 8 to 12 cents a piece to produce in volume. So, you know, $1 to $1.20 is already a tenfold increase over cost. These profits, in an important article by Gagnon and Lexchen, funded in 2004, 371,000 promotional meetings for what is basically 775,000 physicians. So that's an average of a promotional meeting for every other physician. $20 billion for personal selling, wonderful articles in PLOS Medicine by Adrian Fu-Berman about how drug reps sell friendship. And by the way, I have a good drug for your patients. $16 billion in free samples, which is like a two-tier gift relationship. So I give you free samples, now you're beholden to me, you give them to your patient, and she's beholden to you. $5 billion in seeding trials to sign up clinical leaders, a total of $57.5 billion in marketing, 2.5 times the alleged R&D costs, plus twice as many lobbyists as members of Congress. So we have the Congress here, and then we have the pharmaceutical lobbyists here, which are twice as many and billions for lawyers. Intellectual property rights, again, a key focus of the senator's bill, provide protections regardless of health benefits, and we've just seen the evidence that usually there is very little in the way of new health benefits. And patents, therefore, are essentially a license for corporate price control and a strong incentive for developing small variations and being able to charge several times more for the brand name than the one that's coming off patent, and developing synthetic disease models that are not therapeutic breakthroughs. I have an article on pricing, if anyone's interested. I estimate that the patented prices are about 25 to 100 times manufacturing costs. So that's 2,500 to 10,000% more than costs. And approval for one target then opens the door for prescribing for any condition that they can persuade a physician to prescribe it for. And the companies also shape the regulatory framework. They control public safety testing to a great degree. There's approval based on placebo benchmark. Companies fund the regulator, and we've mentioned that before, and there's a revolving door between upper management in the FDA and either the companies or the firms in Washington that hire professional lobbyists for a few hundred thousand a year. And regulators, as has been repeatedly shown, believe trial evidence of efficacy but are very skeptical about observational evidence of harms, although there's an important article in PLOS Medicine showing that such evidence is equally valid. One thing that really struck me is when I read the United States Inspector General's report of 2003, FDA reviewers, their study found, met 23 times with their own scientific advisory groups, but 1,021 times with company officials. So you can see in an environment like that how the degree to which there's a swamping and sort of takeover of regulators. The FDA officers are repeatedly reported to override their own concerned critical reviewers. They will exclude them from critical meetings. They will strategically ignore them and sometimes exclude critical outside reviewers as well. And when the FDA denies the approval of drugs, companies, quite often there have been a couple of cases in the last couple of years that are rather striking, simply go over the heads of the FDA to a congressman and tell him, you know, you're preventing a great, you're keeping my company from growing, the FDA is obstructing my creating new jobs, and arguments like that. And the industry shapes medical knowledge and education. Extensive supported presenters at Grand Rounds, scientific meetings, and CME, and a great number of the news stories, scientific news and lay news, comes from sponsored sources in the extensive network that the industry has developed in the U.S. and abroad. So they construct accounts and narratives of our bodies, pathology, and treatment. Feminists have some excellent detailed examples of the way in which the understanding of bodies has been medicalized. And there's a special issue of social science and medicine coming out soon on the sociology of diagnosis that will include several articles to that effect. Mass marketing is characterized by the inverse benefit law, which Howard Brody will talk about. The more aggressively drugs are marketed, the more diluted become their benefits, but the more widespread become their risks of harms. And strategies that increase harms include loosening guidelines for prescribing, using surrogate endpoints rather than hard clinical outcomes, exaggerating safety claims, exaggerating effectiveness claims, or creating new disorders for which people don't really need drugs. I learned I had a new disease from watching Ryan Williams in 630 News. I have low T, and I'm wondering what I should do about that. Because I'm over 40, and I've discovered that I'm 10 years older than I was a decade ago. And, I mean, it just blew my mind that that was the case.
Get over it, kid.
I'm trying to, but I need your help as a clinician. Companies circumvent the law even to the extent that it already allows to maximize unapproved uses And there's been an extraordinary swell of prosecutions for illegal practices with huge fines by companies, and some of the key charges by attorneys general and others include concealing evidence of harms in trials, unlawful promotion of unfounded uses, physician hospital kickbacks, known as rebates, except they really aren't, because you don't, it's not like when I sent in a Cheerios box as a kid and got a little toy back. It's not like that. And poor manufacturing processes. So just to conclude, paying for R&D through patents is inefficient and economically unsound. It's part of economic research. But it also fosters the syndrome of corporate and regulatory practices that compromise doctors, distort medical knowledge, and harm patients. And high prices are a great burden on taxpayers and workers. And few new drugs are aimed at unmet needs. So I'll wrap up there, and thank you very much.